You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
You think you're ready?
I think I'm ready.
You think I'm ready? Okay.
This is Scopes Monkey Choir.
The podcast where music and sound meet science and skepticism. Episode 40.
40.
And we got some good stuff. We're going to relay a little story. And wait, why are you looking at me like that?
We have never before introduced our podcast by saying what we're going to talk about, have
That's
we?
That's true. I think maybe I was thinking of the reality check. He always says, we got a really good show for you tonight, or something like that. Or a really cool show. Anyway. All right, then I won't do it.
Well, fine. Then I'll just have to just start talking about what we're going to talk about, which is what dorks we are. Let's start with what dorks we are. So today,
let me count the ways.
Today we were standing on the street in New York in the East Village and waiting to meet some friends of ours for lunch. And while we're standing there, one of us said something. A police car went by, and it went, you know,
Doppler effect.
And I said, I wonder if you could run fast enough to create a Doppler effect for somebody standing on the street.
There we were, people standing around being cool, and we got out our iPhone and we got
produced a tone. Yes,
we started running by each other.
To see if we could produce Doppler effect, and lo and behold, you can.
It was really cool.
Oh, you know, actually, first we tried to figure out mathematically whether we would be able to produce Doppler effect, but it rapidly generated. We couldn't really think of how to figure that out, so we just tried it.
Yeah,
we did
mathematically, if you can't figure it out using the numerals 1 and 2 and the plus sign, then if you can't do it with just that, then I'm lost.
But we had iPhones. This is what we didn't think of at the time. Yeah. All the tools were in our hands, and instead we did the practical experiment.
So we ran by each other, and you can hear it. It's a very slight dip.
And I recommend that everyone try it.
Everyone go out and start running around with tones.
We didn't try it by singing because we figured that you wouldn't be able to produce a really steady tone while you were running.
Right.
But maybe you could. Who knows? But then you might psychologically produce a Doppler effect type sound So wait, so now that we got home, I looked up some speeds and found a formula that's pretty simple for the Doppler effect of sound in air.
Mm.
And here's the thing, the speed of sound in a regular air pressure at about sea level on a reasonable temperature day is something like 670 miles per hour, just under 670 miles per hour.
Oh, I thought it was 700.
Sorry, 770. Yeah. 760. Boy, that was a dyslexic moment. So, you know, it was a humid day, so maybe sound was moving a little slower. But in any case, somewhere around the 760, 770 miles per hour, which is, I'm going to do this in metric because metric is always better, even if it's not as intuitive for us stupid Americans. The speed of sound is about 343 meters per second.
Meters per second.
And then the formula is basically the speed of the wave in the medium, which is to say the speed of sound in air, plus the speed of the sound producer relative to the observer or the listener. And then you divide it by just the simple speed of the sound wave in the medium. So you get just over one, and then you multiply that by the frequency of the wave. So in this case, the speed of sound, 343 meters per second, and then I figured that maybe I could run at 6 miles per hour, which comes out to about 2.68 meters per second. And then you divide that by the speed of sound in air, and you get just over one, like 1.007.
Right.
But then if you multiply that times a 440, which is, I think, what we were producing, 440 hertz, which is not the right A, but whatever, you get 443.4.
Oh, which is just slightly...
Which is just perceptible, just sharp.
Just perceptible, yeah.
Nope, not even that much. Yeah. It's just the tiniest bit sharp, but it is enough for you to know... You would know it was out of tune if you were tuning your instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you were singing with something, you would know that 443.4 is out of tune with 440. And right. It is enough that you can hear the sound of the iPhone shift as you run past...
And
somebody on the street, and we did.
Yeah, and you now know that you can go to the East Village, stand amongst extremely cool people, and be a total dork.
If you're us.
That it's possible. I'm saying it's a reality-based possibility to do that.
I'm not sure that we really had to do an experiment to find that out. I mean,
yeah,
we do
enough.
That every day by just walking down the street.
Yeah.
Well, we actually have a topic for today that's vaguely related to us being clowns.
Humor in music.
Indeed. And we have, in fact, consulted an expert.
Yeah, we were going to do all sorts of, like, I don't know, research. And then we were like, let's just talk to my dad.
Your dad?
Yeah.
Just talk to your dad?
Peter Schickley, a.k.a. PDQ Bach, who is... What is PDQ Bach?
He's a... what is PDQ Bach? Peter Schickley in the 60s, was it?
Started in the 60s.
Started in the 60s,
70s,
yeah.
80s, 90s, and
he,
still?
He discovered the works of PDQ Bach, the last and oddest of Bach's 20-odd children. Anyway, he made a long career of humor in music, a career which is still going on. And he also had a... radio show on NPR, Minnesota Public Radio, called Schickley Mix, which was not really about humor in music at all, but just about music, because he has a vast knowledge of music of all kinds of genres. And we happen to have an in with this guy.
Mm-hmm. A genetic in. So to talk about humor in music, we interviewed him, and here it is. A bunch of episodes back, we were talking about the talking drum. And we were describing the how the talking drum can be used with practitioners that really know how to use it, can be used to, like, actually tell jokes or little stories or something, because they can imitate the language. And that just got us thinking about humor in instrumental music, and how does humor in non-vocal, non-word music work? And what are the ways that it can be done? And it occurred to us that we maybe...
That we have an in with one of the great experts on this subject of the 20th and 21st centuries. And here you are.
Hey. So the question is...
So how the hell do you do it?
Yeah.
How does it work? I mean, go ahead.
Well, it's tricky, and as usual, it has so much to do with context. You know, part of me wants to say you probably can't do it without some sort of a setup. I'm thinking of a trombone slide, for instance. Nah,
right.
Which is often used for humorous effect. But in Dixieland jazz, for instance, it's often used not specifically for humorous effect, and yet it is sort of a good time effect. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a party in an instant.
Yeah, yeah. People are not necessarily going to laugh, but and in the Bob Dylan song, what is it, Rainy Day Women number, mm-hmm. whatever it is, anyway, the sliding trombone is partly what gives that party atmosphere.
Right, yeah.
But obviously... one of the things that's funny in many Spike Jonze recordings, Spike Jonze being the musical humorist who was famous a half a century ago, is a pistol, for instance. But here again, it's because of context.
Mm-hmm.
A pistol shot by itself is anything but funny. But in the context of
a love song, maybe?
Yeah, or even just instrumental music, period. You don't expect to hear a pistol.
Mm-hmm. So with the trombone example is a good one. That, I mean, do you think that the sliding trombone sound, do you think there's something, just because of the sound, that there's something innately like relaxed about it, and so then depending on the context, it either means party or relaxed or funny or I don't know.
Is that sounds like a good hypothesis to me. And then also because I think the music that we're familiar with, both popular and classical. I was just about to say something, and then I found an objection to what I was about to say. I was going to say that it doesn't feature notes changing pitch gradually, like a glissando. It doesn't feature that much.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the slide guitar in country music does exactly that.
Right.
And far from being funny, it usually has a sort of a sad sound.
It's, right, exactly.
It seems to evoke, it almost evokes weeping.
Mm-hmm.
And so there it isn't funny at all.
Yeah. I wonder if that actually has anything to do with just register. I mean, that sort of sliding on the low end, brrr, means it represents something different than...
Yeah.
No, I have I had a totally different angle on it when I thought about asking you this question, because you made at least a lot of the early part of your career on classical comedy, classical music comedy, and there's a sort of a specific, almost a grammar of classical music that we have expectations, we know what chord is coming next, and you turned that into humor in very specific ways, but I wonder whether you thought about it at all or whether it was just like telling jokes in that language.
Probably more the latter. I mean, I certainly was aware. For instance, the reason most PDQ Bach pieces start out, for the first few measures at least, if not more, fairly straightforwardly, is to set up the expectations of the typical classical piece,
mm-hmm.
if there were such a thing, so that the expectation could be broken. But here again, it seems to me that it's very, very thin ice, the whole humorous thing. For instance, when Charles Ives does a similar thing of using basically classical language, but then going... overlapping things or going into
going insane, I believe.
Yeah, right. Is it funny or not? You know,
right?
It's
we could debate that all night.
Yeah, right. And having two different marching bands play simultaneously in different tempos and different keys, it probably does have. I mean, I would say in Ives, there is a humorous element to it, even if it isn't regarded as a funny piece.
Mm-hmm. Maybe this is a rephrasing of Haitink's question, but in your PDQ Bach concerts, you have a lot of different types of humor. You have sort of instrumental references, you have sort of classical setups that you then break the expectation, like you were just talking about. Then you also have verbal jokes in the introductions, and then you have visual gags, and you have all these different things. And did you find there were some kinds of gags that would work on some people but not others, or older people but not younger people, or were there some things that kids would get but others that they wouldn't, or do you know what I mean?
Well, No, I was aware of that somewhat, although I found that I very rarely tailored the material to the audience.
Uh-huh.
It's just... it didn't seem worth it because I didn't know with enough exactitude what would happen. I would say that, mm-hmm. And also just because I found I couldn't predict it that much. I found, for instance, in several experiences that sometimes a very most simple-minded gag, for instance, an egg falling from the top of the stage onto somebody's head,
mm-hmm.
Which we did once at a concert at Aspen. Here we were in this music festival and music school. For the rest of the summer, everybody was talking about that egg coming down on the guy's head and not about the more musical kinds of humor we had going on.
Mm-hmm.
So you just don't know. And obviously that's not musical, as you say, that's a sight gag. But I do know I do know of her people. I've heard from people who have heard certain parts of PDQ Bach music that they don't even regard it as funny.
Right.
They just regard it as music, you know.
Right.
And so somehow, and also in terms of audience reaction that you were asking about, I heard from friends that one guy said his father goes to the concerts just to listen to the spoken introductions. Mm-hmm. He doesn't get the musical references. I was on Howard Stern's show once on the phone. I was on the phone.
Uh-huh.
But he put on the beginning of the 1712 overture of PDQ Bach, and he said, "What's funny about this?" And it's true that two things. One is the reference to Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture musically, right? And it wasn't surprising that Howard Stern didn't see what was funny about it, because the musical relationship of the beginning of the 1712 overture to the Tchaikovsky 1812 overture is that the first few notes of each, the first few notes of the overture are the same as Yankee Doodle.
Mm-hmm.
And the da 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 dee da dee da 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 dee da da. I don't mean that far. The Tchaikovsky is just boom 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 boom.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took it to the Pop Goes the Weasel. Except even there, if you're not listening fairly carefully, you might not even notice that it's Pop Goes the Weasel.
Right.
And then later, I make it even more obvious. But you could listen to that just as a piece of music, you know, and not as being particularly funny at all.
Right. Especially if you didn't know either Yankee Doodle or Bob Goes the Weasel.
Right, right. And that kind of thing happens. One of the forms of humor in my concerts has often been pieces in which there's not a single original note in the whole piece. The whole piece is quotes.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously that has all to do with whether you know the quotes or not. And even within the English speaking community, when I played London a couple of times, there would be songs that virtually everybody here knows, like Stephen Foster songs,
uh-huh,
Way Down Upon the Swanee River or something, that they didn't know. So as usual, it's context.
Right.
Those are the quote the bets.
Yes.
In general.
Right. And that's, by the way, not a form that I invented at all. It goes back at least to the Renaissance, if not more.
You mean that those original quote libets were also quotes?
Yeah, things? Yeah.
Oh.
They were not necessarily even of humorous intent, but I guess it often was humorous intent. Students, I think, did them. Combined school songs and things like that. And it was also popular in the 19th century. Themes from Wagner operas and presented not only a bunch of them in one piece, but also as if they were music hall pieces arranged to be funny. There's another context form of humor. Take a very serious piece,
uh-huh,
and present it like a vaudeville tune.
Mm-hmm.
And
so to sort of change the context that the music is expected to be, that you'd expect to hear,
right,
the music, yeah.
But here again, if you didn't know the source material, you'd just say, oh, here's a nice vaudeville piece.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So to go back to that instrumental one, there are all sorts of things which sound funny within the context of classical music, like ocarinas,
mm-hmm,
and banjo, for instance. Now, banjo is one of my favorite instruments, but if you do a setup for a classical cadenza and a cantata, the way the Black Forest Bluegrass, the Bluegrass cantata does, has a cadence that makes you expect a Baroque aria, and then you hear the banjo. It's funny. But I can imagine somebody from a completely different culture listening to it and not thinking it's funny.
Right, and everyone starts laughing and they look around and they think everyone's crazy.
Yeah.
But that's true of any kind of humor. Humor is so based on humor. It's
Well, it's sort of culture. That's sort of hitting your point, man. Right?
Yeah, although I'm not. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Slapstick's humor, maybe. Well, here again, I'm not an anthropologist. Right. I don't know whether.
But yeah, maybe a good pratfall is funny around the world.
Yeah, you know? But I don't know if slipping on a banana peel is funny in Borneo or not. I mean, maybe they just say, "Oh, poor guy."
Right.
Probably happens all the time.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, in places where it may be a major cause of death.
There's another sort of classical music humor that I am always really impressed with in the PDQ Bach stuff, which is you alluded to a similar thing with the cadence. There's this one cadence in Iphigenia in Brooklyn that I guess is a deceptive cadence carried to incredible extremes.
A big loud chord comes in, you mean?
The improvised cadence that is just continuously deceptive for about 5 minutes.
Right.
That it's coming to an end for 5 minutes. And I was always, I kind of grew up on that record and was always so impressed. I didn't know if it was improvised or not, but that it could go on for so long and that it was absolutely hilarious and I had no idea why. I wondered if you wrote that or if it was...
No, it was improvised. It was the man who played that harpsichord part with Leonid Hambro, who was more than a fine pianist. He was a New York Philharmonics pianist, and he was Victor Borge's straight man for a while, and he was he improvised that completely, and he, as you indicated, he would pick a series of notes which usually leads to an ending, and then he'd extend it and go farther. And then visually he would do that too, where you do the, as if you're about to play the final note, and then you sort of move your shoulders and go on. But there again, that is, as you indicated, is very much a something doing a takeoff on specifically classical music. I can imagine a takeoff in a rock piece of drummers who never quit.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think Spinal Tap has a moment like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and they have exploding drummers too, which is also,
no, but and jazz guy. Too. You get these last quick, and but go on longer than that for real,
right?
You know, and that's really very analogous to the harpsichord cadenza in Iphigenia in Brooklyn.
It seems like we still haven't managed to break out of context anyway. That it's all this. You know, you have visual gags, you have references to other pieces of music, you have types of music out of context that they're normally heard in. You have layering other, like the quidlibets, the layering quotations on top of each other, and eggs dropping on musicians during a concert.
Right. The only thing that I can think of that we've missed is the invention of new instruments.
Yeah, well, I would put that in the same general category as the slide on the trombone, though, because it's the invention of new instruments. The ocarina, for instance, which is a clay flute-like instrument,
mm-hmm.
and within a classical context, it sort of sounds funny, but it's actually a beautiful instrument,
mm-hmm.
a folk instrument and South American instrument and pre-Columbian instrument. And then the other thing about invention of new instruments sometimes has an extra musical thing too. I mean, there was a comedian who made a lyre from a toilet seat. You know, you had the toilet seat, uh-huh. and then strings strung there in the space in the middle. And of course, when you hear just the strings being played, you hear strings being played. They're not particularly funny. It's
right.
only when you see it and the context of it being so completely inappropriate. And it's true that in PDQ Bach concerts, we used a lot of invented instruments. There's a kind of pipe, a corrugated pipe, to hold microphones on. You screw the microphone on the end.
Uh-huh.
If you take the microphone off, you take it, disengage it at both ends, and you blow into it, and you get the overtone series. The harder you blow, the higher the overtone series. So This is something that we used after somebody discovered it, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I was singing one instrument that I always liked, which was just a piece of plastic tubing, and you held it in the shape of a U with one edge towards your mouth, and there's water in the tubing, supposedly wine, and you hold the other edge away from you about a foot in front of your face so that there's a U, the tube U with a liquid in the bottom, and you blow on the end like a flute, so you're going to get a pitch.
Or a bottle.
Or a bottle, yeah. Right, like blowing a Coke bottle or something. So then with your other hand, as you lift the far end of the instrument up and down, the level of the water changes inside, and so you get a different pitch. It's a very difficult instrument to play. It's very hard to control.
Yeah.
But part of its charm is just its unlikeliness. You know, you're going really out of your way to get a very simple effect.
Right. There are all behind you are all these instruments that can do that without precisely and without the
right,
you
know. Right. And the slide whistle is another instrument that is almost always used, as far as I know, for humorous effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like a trombone, but a flute version of a trombone.
Right.
And whoops, used in cartoons a lot for, you know, somebody takes something away from somebody else. Whoop.
Or falling off a cliff.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And in P.D.Q. Bach, there are several pieces where he has music written for slide whistle where you have to do the exact pitch. Here again, it's actually quite difficult.
Right.
And if you do it really well, not that funny.
So part of the humor is watching skilled musicians struggle.
Cry, right.
Yeah. Did you say cry?
Both, I guess.
You once told me years ago, and I don't know if I'm getting it right, but talking about sharp and flat,
uh-huh.
Which just for our listeners, that if you're going for a particular pitch, if you're just under the pitch, it's flat. If you're just over the pitch, it's sharp. You once said to me that in general, sharp was funnier than flat.
Well, among singers,
uh-huh.
It's sort of a cliche, a singer singing flat.
Mm-hmm.
Which some singers do.
It's just not funny because it happens too often.
Yeah, right, right. But to me anyway, and other people, a singer singing sharp is even more painful or more... There's a famous example. There's an album that was called Darlene Edwards and her husband at the piano. And she was actually Joe Stafford, who was a very, very famous and very good pop singer in the mid-20th century. And so she knew exactly what she was doing. But she tended to sing everything sharp. And it's just excruciating. And this album was put out, by the way, without any really obvious indication that it was comedy. And there were people who didn't take it as comedy, just took it as an album. And many people never noticed that the front cover had this atmospheric sort of sexy picture of two hands playing the piano and an attractive woman leaning on the piano and everything. A lot of people never noticed that the two hands playing the piano were both left hands.
Oh,
subtle.
and the liner notes gave no indication that it was humorous. Or no clear indication, anyway.
Right.
And they put out several albums. I mean, it was very well done. But I will admit, on that one, the first time I heard it, without knowing what it was, I did have the reaction, I'll bet she knows exactly what she's doing, because singers just don't sing this consistently out of tune.
Right, yeah.
and sharp.
I've heard it said sometimes that it's basically impossible to fake what a bad singer does if you are any kind of a singer at all, because it's, I don't know why exactly, but we are so, one of the first things that you have to be a singer is able to match pitch.
Right.
And you don't really control it the way you do with the slide on a trombone. You can't just move it a little and make it a little sharper. So a truly bad singer
Florence Foster Jenks, for instance, is out of tune in ways that you can't really even imagine.
Hmm. I can imagine that what you say is true. I obviously somebody like Spike Jonze, who had a comedy band, which included sometimes a singer or more, would have people that would come as close as anybody could to doing that on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm speaking hesitantly because I'm, you know, going through numbers in my mind. But it's more common in Spike Jonze to have the singing be good, be very straight, but then what goes on between the phrases and stuff, you know.
Right.
You always hurt, you know, gunshot and his scream is what's the humor. But the singers were often good singers.
Right. Yeah.
Which was true in your stuff as well.
Yeah.
You actually, it's funnier to watch a good singer, a really good singer, singing an aria whose words are running nose than right, it is right. to hear a bad singer doing
right,
that.
Right. Only he who is running nose. I'll tell a story on John Ferrante, the countertenor that I worked with for many years. And he was a wonderful performer. He was just the kind of performer your eyes had to watch while he was on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And also he had the kind of robust sound that you read that the castrati had in the old days. It wasn't singing in your falsetto in some sort of fairyland way that some countertenors sing in today. But the interesting thing was that one of the P.D.Q. Bach albums, the one with the seasonings, the oratorio called The Seasonings on it, was recorded, I think we only had one evening. It was only one recording one evening, so we had no backups. And his voice cracked in a place where he didn't intend it to. And for the rest of his life, at least whenever I was around, whenever he did that piece, he would crack his voice at the same place so that people would think he did it on purpose.
Oh, wow. That is dedication.
To something. Yeah, right.
Well, thanks very much, Mr. Johann Peter Schickele.
You're welcome. Pleasure.
Since we got on the topic of Jonathan and Darlene Edwards, we just had to play some for you
because
isn't
this
just so damn funny?
So here we go.
I love Paris in the springtime. I love Paris in the fall. I love Paris in the winter when it drizzles. I love Paris in the summer when it sizzles. I love Paris every moment.
Oh, God, I love that so much. It's so painful.
Thanks again to Peter Schickele for joining us on our podcast.
Thanks, Pop. And
Run out of time, so we're going to have to put off the instrument du jour of the week for next week.
Oh, yeah. So last week's hint about this week's instrument du jour of the week is now going to be put off until next week's instrument du jour of the week.
Oh, my God. Play that hint again.
Here's the hint again. Yeah. Okay. So see you next week. Thanks for listening to Scopes
Monkey.
See,
we're going to see them?
Yeah.
That's weird.
It's an expression and talking. It's a human thing.
Thanks for listening.
To Scopes Monkey Choir from ScopesMonkeyChoir.com.
We are professional musicians, not scientists, although we were doing some science on the street today.
If you doubt something we've said, don't believe us. Look it up yourself. Nevertheless.
Each episode page at ScopesMonkeyChoir.com has references and citations.
We love feedback. Write to scumps humping people, ScopesMonkeyChoir @gmail.com, or call the monkey phone and leave a message.
347-788-0330.
I tweet at SquidOcto.
I tweet at ScopesMonkeys. Oh, and write us a review on iTunes. We don't have any.
Yeah, we only have, last time I checked, we only had one. We'd love to get some others.
Yeah, some reviews.
Yeah. And stuff.
And stuff. Okay, bye.
Bye.